I think sometimes Discord can be funner for those playing it than listening to it, but I just want to remark that it was actually equally as pleasant to listen as to play.
Oh.
Maybe even better.
Good. Okay.
Does that make you happy?
I'm glad that it wasn't totally unenjoyable for you. Although, I mean, like, I think certain circumstances would warrant Trash Orchestra perhaps making some noise that certain people might find abrasive. People are there, some kind of protest situation or something like that, and Trash Orchestra could certainly lend a hand in bringing a point to somebody, or something like that, or just a general...
What is the point?
I don't know what the point would be decided at the, or would be known at the time.
And coming up next on Free Radio, 101.1 FM and freakradio.org, it's Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides with your host, Robert Norris, the ineffable Grinmaster Greg in the studio giving backup and critique, and two special callers, a Venezuelan caller at 6:30 talking about the closing down of a television station there, and at 7:30, actually at 7, a call from Susan Prather of Walnut Creek, who is going to be talking about the Richmond camping ban, which actually includes provision for not arresting the homeless if they have not got a shelter bed available for them. So stay tuned.
Really for.
Sun. That was another song from that ineffable disc, Election Day USA. And that one's called Something to Believe In by R3. So, as you may have heard before, it's Free Radio you're listening to, 101.1 FM, also known as Freak Radio. And we are at freakradio.org, in case you're listening on the Internet, which hopefully at least one of our listeners is listening tonight. That's going to be our special guest who will be calling in. His name is George, I got this right, Sicariello Maher, and he's in Venezuela. I think he's in Caracas, actually. That's where I originally read his latest piece on Counterpunch, a lefty news site that I follow frequently and perhaps a little too obsequiously. It's got some interesting stuff. In fact, I'm going to read an article by Patrick Cockburn, or Cockburn, depending on how you want to pronounce his name, shortly about Iraq. This one, however, the article that I'm talking about by George Sicariello Maher, that prompted me to get in touch with him, and then our conversation sort of prompted this interview, has to do with the closing of Venezuela's radio station RCTV. Radio station, television station, RCTV, and I'm going to read about that. It's concerned a number of folks, organizations that are not all right-wing fanatics, and the guest is going to give a defense of Chavez's closing of that station. What does this have to do with homeless people? Well, not a hell of a lot directly. It's way out of the way. But it got me interested, so exercising my prerogative, I'm leaping to discuss this. Chavez is a guy who has been involved in movements to at least throw some cash toward poorer people in his neck of the woods and stand up to U.S. so-called free trade horseshit. So that has interested me, and I think that does impact poor people. Looks like we have a caller calling in. Let's see who's on the line. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert and Greg here. Hello?
Hi. This is George. I'm calling for Robert.
Oh, George. I was just talking about you, George. I am Robert. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Not bad. I've actually pulled up your article on Counterpunch, and I wasn't expecting you to call till 6:30, but welcome.
I mean, I can call back if you want.
Well, what I was going to do is give some introduction. I was going to read your article, at least parts of it aloud. I was going to read some critique from, the reporters... Gosh, what's the website that covers the... It critiques Chavez's move in...
Mm-hmm.
Reporters International? Reporters... What am I thinking of? You might know it. I can find it out. I've got it here. And so I'm going to do this, kind of read some of this stuff aloud for folks for background, and then you can hear us on the air. Are you at a computer where you can actually listen to... something coming off the Internet?
Not likely, but I could check it out.
Oh, well, no, it's all right. Or it depends on your situation. If you want to call back, that would be great. If you want to talk now,
sure,
we can...
Sure, I'll call back.
All right,
call
then.
Call back in half hour.
Sounds good to me. All right. And that's how we work here at Free Radio. We make it up as we go along. So the group I'm talking about is Reporters Without Borders. I'm afraid I finally got a hold of that right name. Reporters Without Borders is a group that's concerned with oppression of reporters, censoring of radio, TV, and other media stations by different kinds of oppressive governments. And that's what I'm going to be reading about shortly, but we have a caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert.
Hey there. Human rights organization organizer, I recognize
Hi.
You, Bernard Klitzner.
Hi, I wanted to ask you if you would give a question, to the person that you're going to interview for Venezuela.
Uh huh.
And my question is he a little concerned, that Congress there has decreed power to one man, and that socialism really is about working people. Running society, democracy should expand, not contract.
Well, I mean, a centralized power can be dangerous, and it should be the people that run things and not the people at the top. That's
right. Mm-hmm. And is he I want to know if he's concerned about that. Would you ask him?
Sure, although you remember his expertise here, although I'm sure he'll have an opinion on that, is going to be, and the subject I called him about, is the decision of the Chavez government not to license, I think it's called RCTV, which is a large right-wing commercial radio station.
Well, I think that's very important to talk to him about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's absolutely important, but also I think my question is also important. Chavez is declaring himself a socialist, and I always thought that working people, that brought greater democracy for working people running production.
Right. Now, I don't know what the implications, again, you got to be more specific about what kinds of power you're talking about. I mean, the fact that Congress has power does not necessarily give more power to working people. I mean, under some circumstances, if authoritarian executives, for example, support workers taking over factories and running them themselves, Even if Congress doesn't, you know, this is a form of, I presume, expanded power, power above, you know, essentially empowering people from below.
We'll find out. Maybe he'll give an opinion about that.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, I'd appreciate it if you would.
Will do.
Ask him. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye bye. Phone lines are open 427-3772, and. Let's see here. I'm going to begin by reading. Well, I'm going to read the actual article that George Sicariello Maher has written, however much I'm butchering his name. And if you can check it out, too, if you want to jump ahead of me or you want to check this out later, it's on the Counterpunch website, www.counterpunch.org. And it's January 12th, 14th. Section of the website. It's called Not About Free Speech, The Case of Venezuela's RCTV. No single news item emerging from Venezuela has made foreigners and especially North Americans more queasy than the recent decision by the Chavez government not to renew the broadcasting concession previously granted to Radio Caracas Television, RCTV. Perhaps with some justification, many have a severe allergy to anything that smells of an attack on free speech, quote-unquote. Such hypersensitivity, however, obscures a crucial detail of the matter. The non-renewal of RCTV's concession is simply not about free speech. The claims of the opposition and the foreign press, which assert a veritable trampling of human rights and press freedom, rest on a series of false claims. One, the Venezuelan government is behaving abnormally. No, it says, contrary to the opposition's framing of the issue, is the broad background of a slide towards authoritarianism and fascism. According to many, Venezuela has stepped decidedly outside the democratic norms governing behavior in the post-Cold War world, and the non-renewal of RCTV's concession is proof of this abnormality. This, however, could not be further from the case. The Bolivarian Constitution of 1999 does boast the most stringent requirements imposed by any constitution on the private media, enforcing above all a broad notion of responsibility on the latter. Media magnates have expressed a clear concern over this provision, and with good reason, since they had been operating irresponsibly for quite some time. Were this constitutional provision fully enforced and legislated, the private media might be able to claim that their existence is somehow more difficult than other media outlets the world over. But as it stands, legal requirements and enforcement are hardly out of the ordinary. The lei resort or media responsibility law has as its objective the social responsibility of radio and television service providers and has been credited with both protecting the rights of children and increasing the amount of domestically produced programming. However, the idea that media concessions entail responsibility is not at all unique. Even the U.S. FCC maintains a similar position. not one of my favorite groups, notwithstanding the swift deregulation during the early years of the Reagan administration. As we all know, the FCC maintains certain content restrictions on broadcasting, or should I say fucking content restrictions on broadcasting, more strict, it should be mentioned, than in many European nations, and is not unwilling to silence those who infringe upon these restrictions. Moreover, ever since the Janet Jackson wardrobe malfunction, the enforcement of such restrictions has been ratcheted up, as in e.g. FCC efforts to shut down infamous radio host Howard Stern, not to mention the continuous closure of smaller outfits, like our own, for instance. And we are only speaking here of so-called, quote, obscenity, which doesn't even compare to the charges against RCTV, which is as well known, actively participated in a conspiracy which brought about several deaths and used those deaths to provoke a coup in April of 2002. This was followed by an equally active participation in the oil sabotage of December of the same year, which crippled the Venezuelan economy toward the same end. While this provides little justification, it is worth mentioning how many FBI visits have been occasioned by threats against George W. Bush, despite the fact that these have been isolated and individual incidents, not the sort of organized rebellion and premeditated murder endorsed by the Venezuelan media. So his first point is it's quite normal for perhaps authorities to close down a station that RCTV is like. The kinds of precedents he's citing, which have to do with RFCC and threats against Bush and Janet Jackson, don't particularly impress me. But let's go on. Number two, human rights are being violated. In his first, this is the claim that he say the critics have about the closing of RCTV or the failing to license it again, which he's going to discuss. Are human rights being violated? In his first significant intervention since being named vice president of Venezuela, Jorge Rodriguez spoke on the subject of RCTV at the swearing-in of Chavez's new ministerial train. He began from the dictionary definition of concession, the juridical means by which the administration cedes to a person the privative use of someone in the public domain, or the management of a public service for a determinative period of time and under certain conditions. Rodriguez added that this is not Hugo Chavez saying this, this is in the dictionary. And yet opposition media outlets attempt to paint the issue of the non-renewal of a concession as a violation of a human right. This right presumably means the right of a large private media conglomerate to have unrestricted access to a public good, to use and abuse this public good for profit without acquiring any responsibility. When RCTV head Michael Granier wants to tug on liberal heartstrings, he adds in the claim that the human rights of the workers are being violated. Yes, you heard it right. RCTV, a division of business group 1BC, is concerned about, above all, with their workers' rights. The government has been quick to point out in response that the concession is not being denied to the workers and has actively encouraged RCTV workers to organize into a collective and request that the concession be granted to themselves. So he's making a somewhat legalistic argument, claiming that human rights are not violated because they're denying it to a large corporation and not to the actual workers in that corporation, and that they're not really denying a right, they're denying a, quote, concession, which, you know, again, this argument doesn't impress me either, but maybe we can, when we get George on, we can get some more specifics about it and he can enlighten me further. Three, is the government closing a media outlet? He disputes this. Many, moreover, have claimed the government is unilaterally closing a media outlet and that to do so represents a sort of qualitative attack on free speech. The fewer media outlets there are, so the argument goes, the less free the press. As dubious as such arguments are in and of themselves, it should be clear that they don't even apply to the situation in question. Channel 2 is not being closed. Broadcasts will continue. The concession to one private corporation is not being renewed and will instead be granted to either another private corporation, a mixed public-private corporation, a collective of workers, or some other combination. In his speech, Rodriguez was clear on this point. Is the Bolivarian government closing down a television station? That's the Chavez government of Venezuela. Is it violating the freedom of expression? No, it's not even revoking a concession. The only television station that was closed during the 8 years of this government was Venezolana de Televisión on that tragic night of April 11th. That's during when they attempted to have a coup and overthrow Chavez. Despite the current rhetoric, the media magnates running RCTV as well as other opposition outlets like Venevisión and Globovisión demonstrated little concern for free speech when they supported this short-lived coup d'etat, which immediately closed down the only media outlet representing the poorest majority of the population, as well as various community media outlets like Katia TV. In fact, the very fact that RCTV will be free to continue cable and satellite broadcasts demonstrates that this is what is at issue, is the private use of a public good rather than the silencing of a media outlet. Now, here I think is an important point, because they're not going to attempt to take this RCTV off the air in terms of satellite and cable, but they're trying to say that the actual direct broadcast will be made available to another group. And since I would imagine there is a limited number of stations for direct broadcast, this argument resounds with me more. Is the gesture the closing of RCTV, or shall I say the withdrawing of its ability to broadcast directly, anti-democratic? The claim that the non-renewal of RCTV's concession violates democratic norms is very much tied with those claims mentioned above, as it similarly revokes an indisputable right, quote-unquote, that private corporations have to a public good. Speaking on Vive TV, influential Venezuelan intellectual Luis Brito Garcia recently made clear that this is indeed a question of democracy, but one which runs contrary to the claims of the opposition media. The non-renewal of RCTV's concession is a step toward the democratization of the airwaves. What socialism could we be constructing, asked Brito, and especially what sort of democratic socialism, if access to the airwaves remained in the hands of a small oligopoly of magnates with international backers? What could be more democratic than handing Channel 2 over to the 63% of the Venezuelans who voted for Chavez? What could be more democratic than allowing RCTV workers to organize their own station? And what could be more democratic than allowing access to the airwaves for those traditionally excluded by the media oligarchy? And it should be mentioned, if we are speaking of democracy, RCTV head Michael Granier has little to say. After all, he and other media leaders actively participated in an anti-democratic and oligarchic coup against a repeatedly confirmed democratic leader in April of 2002, Chavez. For an overview of the role of the media in this coup, see the film The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. Now, this one again seems to me, this argument that somehow it's not necessarily anti-democratic to pull the concession, the license of RCTV for direct broadcast, requires that you have some indication that masses of people want this done, that masses of people need this, maybe that the workers in the station support this, and we'll see if this is the case, at least according to our guest when he calls in about 9 minutes. Number five, another claim. In short, this is an issue of free speech. That is to say, he disputes the claim that this is an issue of free speech. In a recent statement, the head of the Organization of American States, Jose Miguel Isolza, criticized the Venezuelan government for undermining the pluralism of the media. Despite recognizing that this is an issue of domestic juridical competencies, and I guess that means legalities, Isolza nevertheless felt comfortable arguing that the move seems to be a form of censorship against the freedom of expression. Hugo Chavez replied in trademark style, "Isolza is an idiot, from the I to the T." The Venezuelan government has interpreted the OAS chief's words as an intervention into what is a sovereign issue and has called for his resignation. We should bear in mind that Venezuela was among those nations who fought the hard battle to get Isolza confirmed for the position in the first place. If there remained any doubt about the issue about whether the non-renewal of RCTV's concession constitutes an attack on free speech, one need only follow the logic of such an argument. In a session of the National Assembly devoted to discussing Isolza's comments, an MRV deputy, that's one of Chavez's party, did just that, pointing out that the OAS head would have Venezuela restore other similar concessions, specifically those granted traditionally to the multinational oil companies who had looted Venezuela for decades. There is no qualitative difference between the two sorts of concession. Both have been traditionally and undemocratically granted to large corporations which have been given free rein to reap unlimited profits from what is undeniably a public good. No, this is not a question of free speech, but rather, in the words of Venezuelan Foreign Minister Nicolas Maduro, it's about revoking the disgusting privileges of a communication oligarchy allied with international financiers. This is by, again, George Sicariello Maher, who is a PhD candidate in political theory at UC Berkeley, lives in Caracas, and in case you want to reach him, can be reached directly by email at ggjcm@berkeleyedu.edu. And he'll be coming on the air shortly. This is his article that prompted me to have an email discussion with him, and I'm going to read that discussion now. And subject you all to it, since I've chosen to have this on the air. And it's it. I think it's of interest to those of you who, of course, are interested in Venezuela's current situation. But I think it's also of interest to those who are trying to, who are supportive of foreign, well, socialists for one thing, but who are also who are supportive of even sort of Bonapartist leaders, like some consider Chavez to be, people who have sort of strong men in a certain way, who are in power because they are paying attention more so than in other corrupt oligarchies or U.S.-dominated regimes to the needs and rights of local people. So let's see here. I'm kind of looking over my review of our past correspondence. Let's see here. I got to go back a little bit, and I will get the appropriate... I hope I'll get the appropriate stuff. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM. We have a few moments before George calls in, and if you have any questions you want to pass on to me, I'll try to check my email. My email is rnorse3@hotmail.com. We aren't going to have a second line into the studio for this call. Sometimes we do, but I've never quite been able to master that, so I'm not going to take a chance on losing a caller from Venezuela on this issue. He's footing the bill for this, so I appreciate that, and I want him to have an opportunity to speak, and I'm going to do that. So, again, I'm trying to review the history of this, see if I can... I think I'm getting to it. Yeah, I think this is it here. I asked him several questions in an email. I asked him how significant... how much of the media spectrum or the viewing audience does RCTV take up? Is it necessary to shut them down or to allow space for others? Or is this a straight case of anti-sedition action, that is, say, shutting down a station that you think is dangerous to the health or life of the country or is, you know, a bad station, without there being a need for others to use the space? And his response is, RCTV's share of the audience is large, perhaps second only to Venevisión. In terms of space, the UHF spectrum is totally full, so that's a factor, but so are the RCTV violations. And he actually sent me a separate article detailing those violations, which I confess I have not read. My mea culpa, George, but hopefully maybe you'll be able to summarize what those violations are. I always think it's important to take independent positions on these issues, much as I'm sympathetic with the Chavez government, and other people that I've read about on this controversy are sympathetic with the Chavez government. But the question is this a good move? Would we, you know, is this a form of unwise censorship? Or is it, in fact, something else? And, of course, the author here is claiming it's something else. It's a form of democratizing the media just and not granting unfair monopolistic concessions to one large reactionary station that has had a lot of violations. It's been involved in trying to unconstitutionally and by force and violence overthrow the government. Here's what Reporters Without Borders writes. Let's see if I can get to the proper one first here. President Chavez says commercial TV station's license will not be renewed. Reporters Without Borders today condemned the Venezuelan government's decision announced by President Hugo Chavez to withdraw the license of Radio Caracas Televisión, RCTV, Venezuela's oldest commercial TV station. The organization reiterated its appeal to the government to revise its stance on the broadcast media and to create an independent body to assign and renew licenses. There will be no license renewal for this putschist TV station called Radio Caracas Televisión, Chavez announced on December 28th. Here we will not tolerate any news media that is in the service of those who make coups against the people, against the nation, against national independence, and against the dignity of the republic. Venezuela must be respected. RCTV maintains that it signed a license contract under the 2000 telecommunication law a year after it took effect. RCTV President Marcel Granier said he would file a legal appeal in order to hold on to the license, which expires in 2021, he said. This is disputed by the government, which claims that the assignment of frequency to RCTV expires the 27th of May, 2007. When Communication and Information Minister William Lara recently denied that the government planned to hold a referendum on RCTV's future, he nonetheless indicated that the renewal of its license was not assured. Grenier said, "What is clear is that the government's desire to harass the station to make it change its independent line, which historically has been its distinguishing feature." He added that other privately owned media could suffer the same fate as RCTV. And then a later story, a later report from Reporters Without Borders. Government looking at three options for privately owned broadcaster. The Venezuelan government is considering three options for the future of the privately owned broadcaster Radio Caracas Television, RCTV. Communication and Information Minister William Lara said on 29th of December, a day after President Chavez announced its license was to be rescinded. One option, Lara said, would be to entrust the running of RCTV to community media or small production companies. Another possibility would be to create a mixed broadcast frequency for a company that was half public, half privately owned. The third option, he said, would be for the state to take control of RCTV and for it to become an entertainment channel also available on cable. If the third option was chosen, the state-owned Canal 8, would be turned into a 24-hour news and talk show channel. Vice President José Vicente Rangel, who is a former journalist, said the government had no intention of expropriating RCTV. At the same time, Foreign Minister Nicolás Maduro defended President Chavez's 28th of December announcement, saying it was necessary in order to democratize the media. Reporters Without Borders takes note of this evolution in the Venezuelan government's position on RCTV and says no decision should be taken without the agreement of RCTV's owners. Founded in 1953, RCTV is Venezuela's oldest commercial broadcaster. Along with other news media, it supported the April 2002 coup attempt against President Chavez. In the studio with me is media expert Grinmaster Greg, whose main media is his guitar and his voice. Greg, any reaction to any of this?
Of course. It deals with issues of information, dissemination of information, knowledge, the whole ideal of media, radio transmission, television broadcast, that's crucial to any civilization, any society now. And vested interests, historically, have always tried to have a lock on it one way or another. And the crucial issue to me is what is considered a fair and just balance between private interest and the public good.
Well, I guess one of the things that's being proposed is that there be some independent agency that makes these decisions, and also Reporters Without Borders is saying, or the spokespeople here anyway, are saying that it should be done with the approval of the owners of the station. Now, I don't know if you're ever going to get the approval of the owners. I mean, the FCC, when it makes decisions, not that I support the FCC, but if you support FCC regulation of large corporations, which I think a lot of us do, though not necessarily of micro-power broadcasters in the way they're doing it, like us here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. And by the way, that's one reason I'm doing this issue, is because it is about the government and radio stations, and so we have a certain interest in this. Those of us who are free radio broadcasters, those of us who support free radio in Santa Cruz, and I'll be asking our guest when he calls in about free radio in Venezuela and how that's going down there. It is a matter of some importance. And, you know, it's not something, I guess, it's not something you're going to walk out and change by exercising or by stating a position one way or the other. But it's an issue I'd like to come to a clearer understanding of, and that's why I'm raising the issue myself.
Well, the problem of media consolidation into fewer and fewer hands that are primarily commercial in nature seems to do a disservice to the public good overall, and that's what the battle in the United States has been about in terms of getting the FCC to live up to its original charter to essentially regulate the public airwaves. And here's your phone call. All right, now I see it ringing.
Sounds like we got our caller coming in. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, this is George again from Caracas.
George, give me the proper pronunciation of your last name. I've been butchering it badly here.
My last name is pronounced Chicarello Mar.
You're definitely butchering it. Chicarello Mar.
Yes.
Let me try to remember that or make a quick note of it. In the studio with me, George, is is Gregory, who is a street musician and a supporter of Free Radio Santa Cruz, which, as you probably know, I've mentioned to you, it's a micropower illegal station. You're speaking illegally. I hope you realize that. And we've just read over your article on Counterpunch, and then Reporters Without Borders. That was a group I was trying to find the name of.
Okay.
Their response to this. And first of all, how's everything in Caracas?
It's good. It's warm.
Wow. Well, you know, if any time you wish to, you know, finance some of our local broadcasters to come on down and give our opinions, we'd be happy to do that. You know that. I've read your argument in its totality. The five objections you said, or the five claims that free speech are being violated, this is an issue of democratization, and your refutation to these arguments. A couple of concerns of mine came up, and I wanted to kind of lay them out for you and get your thoughts on them. And some of them I've expressed to you already.
Sure.
Let's see if I can. Here we go. Okay. Your first point was the Venezuelan government is behaving abnormally. That is a critical response that you kind of debunked. And I guess for us here, I mean for me here, I don't know about Greg. Governments, you know, often take liberties with the media that they can. I mean, it may be acting normally, but isn't acting properly and isn't acting in the interest of the people. And I guess let me give you a chance to sort of expatiate on this, to talk about this. You think, presumably you think that denying this concession is a good idea?
Oh, yes, I do, absolutely. My concern when the issue first sort of came into the news was more about the reception and how it would be played, essentially, and how it would actually work out for the government and the process. But the more that it progresses, the more convinced I am that it's an incredibly good step to be making at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, the first point, which is about arguing that the government's behaving abnormally, is really directed at those media outlets that are acting as though that's what's going on. So, for example, when you read the American coverage of the issue, they often treat it as though it's something that would never occur in their own country. And I think we know that's the case. As you point out correctly, that doesn't necessarily make it right. But the point of that part of the argument was to say, this is what people are saying about it. Is it the case or not?
Well, on reading the reporters, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Reporters Without Borders indicates, it kind of quotes Chavez as making a statement in December, a rather strong statement about RCTV, let's see if I can find it here. Here it is. He said specifically, there will be no license renewal for this putschist TV station, which here we will not tolerate any news media that is in the service of those who make coups against the people, against the nation, against national independence, and against the dignity of the republic. Venezuela must be respected. Now, I could hear George Bush making the same comments about Democracy Now and trying to shut it down. You might say, well, in one case, the person would be right, and in the other case, it would be wrong. But you know, Reporters Without Borders urges that there be some sort of independent commission to do this rather than, say, a statement or decree from a strong president. I guess Chavez is president, or is he? That's his position, right?
Yes, he is president.
Right. I mean, he has an unusual amount of power, does he not, for a South American leader, or is that just a false impression I have?
I mean, it's a difficult question to answer, mostly because it depends really on what we mean by power. Are we talking about official power? Are we talking about informal power?
In
a general sense, mm-hmm. I would say, including informal power, I'd say, yeah, it's extraordinarily powerful.
Mm-hmm.
But this is mostly because of the support that he has, which is to say, he wouldn't actually be president right now if it weren't for the fact that popular organizations went to the streets and brought him back into power after the coup in 2002. And so that's in a sense, a power he's got because he's got support from these organizations, but it's not something that is sort of his to do as he will with.
What are the checks on Chavez's power?
What are the checks?
Yeah.
The National Assembly and the Supreme Court of Justice are the official checks. And beyond that, the
as I said, one significant check has been whether or not he's got popular support for his policies.
And where, I take it you haven't agreed with everything Chavez has done down the road.
No, not entirely.
So if that's the case, I mean, you and I, I'm sure, you're familiar with, you know, the concern that individuals may have the best intentions, but they can abuse power, and that absolute power, you know, power corrupts and all that sort of thing. Have there been circumstances where Chavez has been essentially rebuffed or controlled by either the people at the mass base or these traditional organizations and political institutions like, you know, the judiciary and the National Assembly?
I think certainly. I think one of the biggest concerns by a lot of radicals in the process is that the process is coalescing around Chavez as a figure. And it's something that, on the one hand, he's recognized. He's said, you know, I'm not the revolution. The revolution is all of us. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he probably hasn't done everything that he could to eliminate himself as a figurehead of the movement. And I guess the best way to recognize whether or not he's been pressured by the popular sectors of the movement is to look at the process as it's developed. And when Chavez came to power, he was really not entirely sure what he wanted the movement to be. It was sort of a nationalist, social democratic type movement. And as the process has moved on, certain sectors have been able to push the movement much more to the left. And this happened significantly after 2002, at which point the movement took a sharper turn to the left. And I think most people think it's taking an even sharper turn to the left now. I would have to see that as a sort of pressure that's being put on Chavez to move to the left, because most of his party apparatus, which is the MVR, is more centrist than this stage of the movement. It's a party that doesn't really want to go much further than this, and it's really the radical sectors that don't have official power that do want it to go further.
I follow your point, and I'm supportive, actually, of this kind of stuff, but what are the checks on him if he decides to suddenly, you know, start acquiring a harem and, you know, killing his enemies? I mean, you know, I'm not saying any of this is likely or possible. What are the real checks on him in terms of abuses that leaders like Stalin and Hitler and other individuals that, you know, I'm sure that George Bush would love to compare him with, or, you know, absolutists in any country? What are the real checks on him now? That's what I'm asking you about, not just what might move him further to the left, which is a good idea as far as I'm concerned, but what would stop him from abusing power? Who would stop him? RCTV?
I mean, the checks on him are like the checks that exist in other countries, which is to say the National Assembly, the Parliament, and the Supreme Court of Justice.
You think
the
they actually
National Assembly
have the...
right now is technically 100% Chavista, because the opposition decided not to run. But within it, you've got sort of the radical bloc, and you've got the centrist bloc, and these are blocs that are vying for power and vying for influence on the process.
Now, are there factors to be contended with? Are we talking about something like the Soviet Parliament in the 30s, or the Reichstag, or, you know, some of these, you know, or I don't know, you know, other assemblies in certain Latin American countries that may have no real power? The United States, for that matter.
Plenty of power. It's just a question of whether or not the people in it agree or disagree with the process. I mean, it's a number of parties at this point. It's got 10 or so parties represented in it.
Does Chavez have to go to this group in order to get, you know, permission or consultation before he proceeds with initiatives, or does he essentially, you know, take the initiatives he wants, you know, or that perhaps the certain groups in the parliament want, or the National Assembly want without that? I mean, I'm trying to find out what makes him, if he makes, you know, comes to arbitrary decisions on any subject, you know, what stops him? And I don't mean theoretically what stops him, but practically what stops him.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He's got to consult the National Assembly. The National Assembly is the legislative power. So a good example is what's going on right now is he's requested what's called an enabling law. Mm-hmm. And what this is a temporary move by the legislature to grant him power to be able to issue decrees for a certain time frame with regard to a certain number of issues. And he's had to request this because he can't just go around decreeing laws. Otherwise, they have to be passed by the National Assembly.
Yeah, but
what the Assembly now is deciding is if they want to grant him this power for the next however many months to issue laws.
But why? I mean, that's an interesting question. Why would he need this kind of power? This sounds like the kind of law that was granted in the 30s to, you know, Hindenburg, which paved the way for Hitler to come to power. I mean, the Enabling Act allowed, you know, the destruction of what German democracy there was. Why does Chavez need this kind of power? Why not? Why can't the legislature make these decisions?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the first the first issue is the issue of Germany. It's a, I mean, it's a much different issue. That was called an enabling act, but
right.
it was actually a state of emergency act in a sense. What is going on in Venezuela is strictly confined within the bounds of the Constitution, and it's limited in time, and it's limited in sort of the sorts of laws that can be made on what subjects and with what severity. It's limited to regular law. It can't be any kind of modification of the Constitution, and it can't be what is called an organic law, which is a sort of more serious law upon which other laws are based. So it's really just sort of run-of-the-mill legislation. As to the question of why it's necessary, it's a question of time, actually, because it takes much longer for the National Assembly to pass laws than it does for, obviously, for them to be decreed. And this all goes back to the fact that the Constitution is new. It's from 1999, and some estimates say that up to 92% of the legislation existing hasn't been updated with the Constitution. It's pre-existing legislation that hasn't been adjusted. And so what the enabling laws exist for is really to bring legislation up to date with the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a question, Greg?
Well, I'd like to actually make a statement on that or ask George. This
sure.
This attempt to, as it's playing out in Venezuela, the I would call it the reengineering of that society there. Certainly, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. But I thought much of this need to rule by decree was probably tied in with its recent attempts to nationalize private industry or foreign investment industries there,
mm-hmm.
such as the energy. Wouldn't you think that's actually connected to that?
Yes, it is, actually. As I said, the enabling laws have to do with specific areas, which is to say the
that's a pretty gutsy thing to do, actually.
From the legislature. Request to be able to legislate in this and that area. And one of the areas specifically is nationalization, yes.
Yeah, when you're going to step on Exxon's and British Petroleum's toes and stuff, you got to be pretty ballsy to do something like that. And I could see why you'd want to shore up things in the home front.
Yep. The first nationalizations are actually going to be things like Conteve, which is the national telephone company, and the national electric company. And those have, they have foreign investors, but they're not... certainly not in Exxon or anything like that. But, I mean, this is a president who hasn't shied away from attracting the ire of foreign corporations in the past, and I'm sure he'll continue to do so in the future.
A question which a caller called in on earlier and wanted me to ask you. It's a more general question. You're a socialist yourself or not?
I consider myself a left communist.
Okay. And his question was... he's concerned that Congress is being asked to decree power to one person and that this is not really what socialism is about. It's about working people running society and sort of a democratic organization at a grassroots level. And I guess I mean, the same kinds of concerns that, you know, Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht had and their concerns about the way Lenin was dealing with society in Russia at that time. I mean, it's an old dispute, but I mean, what's your reaction to that question?
Yeah, it's kind of paradoxical what's going on here because, for example, another of the areas that Chavez is asked to be able to legislate in is popular participation. And so what he's asking for is the ability to pass laws with the goal of facilitating popular participation, specifically the creation of what are called communal councils, which are like sort of local, I want to say Soviet, but they're not just for workers necessarily, but local community decision-making for development projects, for education, all sorts of things. And so what is being required is that there be put into place the institutional framework for this to happen. And this paradoxically requires some kind of intervention from the top, especially when you've got a state structure which is resisting this. And so it's sort of a difficult thing to get your head around, which is the idea that an intervention from the top of the state, not just within the state, but the top of the state, can actually help to attack the state itself. The new minister for citizen participation and social development, David Velasquez, is actually the first communist to be named to the Venezuelan to name a minister in Venezuela ever, and he's a young 28-year-old sort of radical communist, and he actually recently wrote the law on communal councils, and he's explained his hope as rendering the state apparatus as it exists today unnecessary.
So. You use the word communist matter-of-factly and unapologetically. You're obviously you're not living in this country in 1956 at the moment. But what's the feeling? Is this a phrase that's not really used much in American media description of the Chavez discussions of the Venezuelan internal politics? Are we talking about when you say communist? What do you mean?
When I'm speaking about the communist
dictatorship
of
the proletariat,
he's a member of the Communist Party, which is obviously a traditional party in Venezuela, and it's always been a reasonably powerful party on the left. It's been slightly to the left of other traditional communist parties. It was slightly less Stalinist, but not without its problems in the 60s and 70s. And at this point, it stands sort of toward the left of the Chavista coalition in terms of the large parties. There are three large parties outside of the Chavista party. The Chavista party, the MVR, gets most of the votes. And outside of that, there's a social democratic party called Podemos. There's a sort of slightly social democratic but also slightly cadre-based party called the Patria para Todos, which is sort of Homeland for All. And then there's the Communist Party, and these are the three big parties outside of that. So the fact that he's a member of the Communist Party puts him slightly to the left of the Chavista coalition. Now, Chavez hasn't described the revolution as communist in any sense. I mean, he's referred to Marxism, he referred to Trotsky recently, but that's obviously a term that he shied away from, like most political leaders since the 90s. If you look at the Zapatistas, they also eliminated the word socialism from their vocabulary shortly after the Soviet Union collapsed. And so I think this is just a common trend for it to be eliminated. But, I mean, talk of communism is obviously more common here than it would be in a place like the United States.
Again, I guess I want to go back to the question because I didn't get a clear answer. What, in your mind, would stop Chavez from acting imprudently, dictatorially, in favor of a particular interest group over the interests of the people, not just theoretically but practically? And has that ever come up, and have you ever been in a position where you or others, or you're aware that others were trying to stop that and successfully did stop that?
I mean, I haven't been personally in a situation like that.
I don't mean there's plenty of checks. Right.
As I said, the National Assembly just voted to hold up the vote on the enabling law until they get some clearer answers from the executive. And this is them flexing their muscles a bit. They will pass the law eventually, but they're sort of trying to show their autonomy a bit in that way. But I mean, I have to say, unfortunately, I think one of the bigger checks on Chavez is that, aside from his own hopes and desires about the revolution, which we can't have perfect access to, I think one of the biggest checks is the fact that there's so much opposition to him in powerful sectors of Venezuela and on the global scale, obviously. He frankly can't afford to be a non-popular leader. He's already a leader who's at the height of his popularity in some ways, was toppled by a coup, and it was, it nearly became permanent. So I think, to say it again, unfortunately, one of the biggest checks is the fact that if Chavez doesn't have the support from radical sectors, if he doesn't have the support from not just a simple majority but a large majority of the population, then he's already in a lot of trouble.
Are you in essence, so you don't have any anxiety about, a Bonapartist, strongman, Hitler-esque kind of, Chavez dies and somebody else takes over and he's got power under the enabling law, that we have a process by which somebody makes an announcement that the station's license is going to be, the concession is not going to be renewed after May or whatever. That kind of thing. I mean, you feel there are adequate checks in place that would stop that kind of, dictatorial approach.
I do. I mean, it's not to say that there aren't any risks, and I think everyone working with the revolution should have anxiety. But I think the biggest anxiety is that the revolution stop in its tracks, and then it become bogged down by bureaucracy, that it become bogged down by corruption, which is one of the bigger problems in the Venezuelan government. And that it just stopped progressing, because I think it is one of the most important experiments in socialism that's ever existed, and certainly the most important experiment going on currently. And so the worst thing for that would be for it to stop.
We're talking with George Chicarillo Maher, whose name I may have butchered again, I don't know, who is a writer, an activist. You're what exactly are you? How do you describe yourself?
I'm a writer while I'm here. I'm also a doctoral candidate at UC Berkeley. I'm currently writing a dissertation there, but also sort of living here.
What's your dissertation on?
It's on revolutionary subjectivity.
Which means?
How revolutionary organizations are consolidated, how revolutionary consciousness develops in groups.
And looking into the United States, do you see any such circumstances developing, perhaps in your native Berkeley?
No, Berkeley is an interesting place. I mean, there's a lot of important things going on in the United States. I think the anti-prison movement is incredibly important. I think the movement around Latino immigration is also incredibly important. I think these are things that have a lot of potential for the future. But it's difficult to be optimistic about politics in the United States, as you know.
Let me ask you a question.
Okay, go ahead, Greg.
George, a question for you, brother. What
sure.
kind of support does he have from the military establishment itself, since traditionally that's been a bulwark against unpopular governments? You know, they tend to overthrow mm-hmm. things. What do you think?
In Venezuela, you're talking about?
Yes, yes. What kind of position relations he have with the military?
It's quite good at this point. The first thing to note is that the Venezuelan military has historically been a lot different from in other countries. It had a different sort of education system from early on. It had a number of economic and political circumstances that prevented it from being sort of an Argentine or a Chilean military. So it's never been quite as right-wing, and it's always been a bit more in touch with the bases, especially at the lower levels. The generals and the admirals have always been a bit more reactionary, but, you know, the corporals and the colonels, Chavez himself was a lieutenant colonel, have always been more in touch with sort of popular sentiment. And so Chavez's support, especially being a paratrooper and a lieutenant colonel, has always been reasonably good. As he found out during the coup, it wasn't perfect. But we should point out that the coup was led by a number of high officials who actually didn't have any troops under their control. So it was an interesting maneuver. But since the coup happened in 2002, the consolidation of the military, I think, has progressed significantly. And I don't think there's any risk of a coup at this point.
We originally, of course, began this conversation talking about RCTV, I guess Venezuela's oldest, privately owned TV station, and its so-called, is that accurate, or?
I think it is the oldest, yes.
And it's described by Reporters Without Borders as its most popular and most listened to or most watched station. Is that accurate?
I think it is the most popular, either that or another private station called Venevision. They're both quite popular.
And so the issue, as I expressed it to you, my problem is I'm running out of time. I've got another person who's going to call in shortly. Interesting conversation. I'd like to continue it. Maybe we can continue it. I don't know. You're probably taking off. You won't be here in half an hour, I take it.
No.
Yeah. Well, let me see what kind of calls we get on this issue, and let me hope that we can pick it up again at some point. I don't know. You know, get in touch with me. Let me know how much this costs. Maybe we can split the cost of this with you so you don't have to, you know, pay for all this all by yourself. I don't know how much the cost is for a half an hour call from Venezuela. I appreciate you doing it, though. If people have questions, sorry, go ahead. If people have questions for you, can they email you and as I've done, and maybe get some responses from you?
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be great. Yeah, my email is gjcm@berkeley.edu. I'd love to hear any questions.
gjcm@berkeley.edu. Okay. Great. Any concluding comments you want to make?
No, it was quite thorough. Thanks very much for having me.
Well, I wish we had been more thorough because I appreciate your willingness to stand up under the somewhat, well, it's not withering fire. We got to get a couple of right-wingers in the studio to tear you apart, and we'll see what happens then.
Yeah, thanks, George. Appreciate that.
And we've been talking with, give us your name again. We've been talking
My name?
With, yes.
Yes, George Ciccarello Marr.
And, George, again, your article can be found on January 12th through 14th, counterpunch.org, if people want to go there and read you. And I guess you can probably be Googled and found elsewhere as well. Huh?
Yep, and I should have some more articles coming out in the near future on other moves by the government, just sort of clarifying the stakes involved in these gestures.
Okay, well, vive la revolution.
Let me say one last thing. Go Bears.
Go Bears.
There you go. Thank you, George.
Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye. And again,
Harris.
We were talking with George Ciccarillo Maher, a writer and supporter of a communist who supports Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. Call-in number is 427-3772. But if you call in now, I'm probably going to have to give you short shrift, unfortunately, because we're up against a second guest who I'm hoping is going to call in shortly. That's a woman named Susan Prather. Susan is an activist from Walnut Creek who has been outspoken in supporting the rights of poor and homeless people up there with her own social service work, and also testified effectively before the Richmond City Council to add to the language of their camping ban, for the first such move in the state of California that I'm aware of, language that made their law, the camping law, comport with the famous Jones decision of Los Angeles, the decision that says you can't arrest a homeless person for sleep crime or camp crime or breathing crime, that sort of thing. You can't arrest a homeless person for falling asleep unless you have a place for them to go where it will be legal for them to fall asleep. You can't simply say that otherwise you're making homelessness itself a crime, and that's a violation of the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. Cruel and unusual punishment. Hey, hey. So Susan and other activists, an attorney, Elisa de la Plena, is another person I've talked to up there who has been helpful in fighting for homeless rights in Fresno. But she also testified before the Richmond City Council way back in May of last year. And they were able to persuade, apparently, a real Green Party mayor up there, not as distinguished from a bogus Green Party mayor like our own former council member Tim Fitzmaurice. You may remember Tim was it's hard to tell, a flickering green, I'm not sure what you would call him. But he supported criminalization of homeless people down here and still does in supporting the sleeping ban law. And supporting its expansion as well, as he has on numerous occasions, for example, in the so-called permit parking phenomenon. Yeah, so Greg has not the kindest words to say about former council member Tim Fitzmaurice. Ironically, Fitzmaurice, of course, was further to the left than anybody else on the council, which just shows you how progressive Santa Cruz is. Of course, look at what happened to Measure G. You can't get a goddamn minimum wage in Santa Cruz. You know, everyone just gets together and just wants to help out those poor businesses downtown. Anyway, what I'm going to do now is turn to that Richmond law. And well, before I do, I'm going to play let's play a little street interview action and see if we can actually get back down to the nitty gritty of the streets. We've been flying high.
Can we turn his headphone up?
And we'll see what we can do here. Hang on.
It's about 1:05 on January 14th, 2007, out here in front of New Leaf Market, as a gang of four on washed-up accordion, banjo. I guess it's a keyboard rather than an accordion. And then there's a fourth instrument, a musical saw, and a washboard. Five people, actually. They're getting a little spare change from a crowd of about 10, 15 people who are discreetly arrayed off to the side and allowing people to pass by in the sunny, cool day here. It's a Sunday. A day without a Bathurst Spears broadside show, because Free Radio Santa Cruz was not broadcasting today, so I was able to wander the streets. Dropping small bits of change into the large black hat that's supposed to be receiving funding. The gang
gang is playing illegally since they are within 10 feet of a sidewalk cafe, the central area. We have some criminal musicians and dancers here who are dancing illegally, a shocking phenomenon in Santa Cruz. We'll try to interview some of these serial dancers in just a moment, but they look rather dangerous, particularly the strange motions. They encourage others to engage in lawless behavior. And actually, Alfresco's is the only cafe that's open. Campesino is closed. I better have a word with Marilyn of Alfresco's. Marilyn, are you aware these musicians are violating the downtown ordinances?
Yes, I'm aware of that.
Now, how can you allow such lawlessness to go on near your domain?
I'll just wait and see how it impacts me, and then...
So in other words, it's more, how is this going to affect the bottom line?
Yeah, partly.
A candid merchant here on Pacific Avenue. Any other reports of Free Radio about interesting things that have happened on the mall recently? I understand you're rather under a somewhat strict series of guidelines where if you change your menu, you have to go to the redevelopment agency to get to, from whom you rent, permission, provided that is, so you can't really change it in terms of competing with other stores, other kiosks. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And what kind of an asshole are you?
I'm sorry?
What kind of an asshole are you trying to stop the small businessmen from trying to make a living?
Have you been drinking again?
No, I'm not a drinker. I'm a smoker.
Ah, well, I won't hold that against you.
Well, thank you for that, sir. At least you're not completely prejudiced.
Certainly not. Actually, you probably misconstrue what we're discussing here.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about the people here who were playing music and things, and you were trying to stop them from doing it. I didn't understand what you were talking about.
Actually, Marilyn here is... Why don't you go ahead and order us, since we'll get out of your way. Marilyn is actually a supporter of musicians, as am I, but the laws downtown forbid them from doing what they're doing, so police can run around and harass people selectively. So I was making a kind of a sarcastic commentary on that.
And what was your commentary so I could really understand what you're
saying? Well, I was saying, you know, goodness gracious, here are these people violating the law. Why aren't you calling the police?
That's what I thought you were saying.
Which is, in essence, saying how ridiculous the law is.
Well, the law is very ridiculous, and we know that they're making money from breaking the laws.
Well, I mean, the fact that these laws are set up...
Not the people that are here. I'm talking about the law enforcement agencies.
And the merchants who... the other merchants who set up the laws.
They are bigger crooks than the crooks themselves.
I tend to agree with you in a certain sense. No question about it. We're talking with?
You're talking with Jim Tolosano, an independent filmmaker and a book writer, novelist.
What have you written, Jim, that people might have heard of?
Well, I'm writing it right now. It will be my first.
All right, then. What will the book be on?
It will be called Homeless for Dummies.
Very interesting. You know, I work with a group called HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. Let me give you a card for the website. Maybe you can let us know when it comes out.
I would love to touch bases with you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's about 2:20 on January 17, 2007. I'm in the basement of the county building, just having stepped out of Department 10, Kim Baskett's court. I'm talking with...
Hugo Arana.
And...
Camilo Arana.
And you were here contesting a citation.
Yes, I was.
Officer C.H.B. Murray was the officer who gave you a ticket?
Yeah, he gave me a ticket for not wearing my seatbelt.
So describe what happened. This sounds like has this ever happened to you before? Have you ever gotten a ticket for a seatbelt?
I have never gotten a ticket for a seatbelt. I have gotten other tickets, but not for a seatbelt. And it never happened before that I was challenged to a fight. And
that's part of one of the reasons you came, because you were upset with what happened in the middle of this whole stop.
Yeah, that's it. I don't know if they are going to throw away the ticket, but I wanted it to be on the record, the unprofessionalism of the officer, David Vogel, who was threatening me and my son.
So describe for us, I know you did this before in court, are you up to giving us a description of how the whole thing ran again?
We got in the truck, my son and I. We always have a little game of putting our seatbelt to see who clicks the seatbelt first. We played a game that day, and I won. I was wearing my seatbelt, he was wearing his seatbelt. We were three blocks from home. We drove back home. We were listening to radio, some Rita, my son always listened pop music and loud, so we were singing that to that music. I never saw the officer or heard any siren following me. Mm-hmm. When I turned the last corner to my house, the officer was behind me. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I saw the lights, I pulled over, I stopped. And he approached me and asked me for my registration and ID, mm-hmm. and told me that I had been pulled over for not wearing my seatbelt, to which I did not contest because I don't contest officers on the street. I give them the right.
Did you have your seatbelt on?
I did have it on.
Is it typical over-the-shoulder seatbelt?
It's an over-the-shoulder. It's I think it's called a three-point over-the-shoulder.
What kind of a car were you driving?
Ford pickup truck with tall seats. So I don't know if it would not be visible from the back that I was wearing my seatbelt, but I was wearing it.
So you think it would be visible or wouldn't be visible?
It wouldn't. It probably would not because the
but if you check that out, if you had somebody look at the, if you walked back to see, I guess you say the driver did a U-turn is what your testimony was.
Yeah, he said he did a U-turn.
Did he claim that later, he didn't actually, I heard the officer's testimony in court. So, the officer then, did he make any remarks to you while he was asking for your license and registration? What was the first thing he said to you?
When he asked me for my papers, I just produced it and gave it to him. Then he said, you know why I pulled you over? I said, I don't know. And he says, for not wearing your seatbelt. And I said, oh, I'm surprised. I was wearing my seatbelt. Mm-hmm. And that was all the change. Then he walked back to his car to check the validity of my license.
Is that the officer?
Yes, that's the officer.
David. Officer Murray just passed us on the court.
Yeah. So that was it. And then after he gave me the ticket, he asked me or accused me of being drunk on the drugs because he said my eyes were red. And which, of course, I wasn't drunk. I don't drink at all. I never do any substances. Then
what was the nature of this? Did he say, have you been drinking? Or did he say, excuse me, sir, have you had anything to drink? In other words, what was the nature of his tone?
But he said, why are your eyes red? And I said, I don't know. I work in construction. My eyes get red sometimes due to dust. And I kept Vicing with me to put some drops on my eyes. And I look for the Vicing, and I show it to him, and that was it. And then he said, are you drunk? And I said, no.
And what was his remark? Did you say anything further?
No, he didn't say anything further regarding that.
And well, let's ask the witness here. Now, is that an accurate account?
Yeah, everything he said there is true.
And you were, how did you feel about this? Were you uncomfortable? Were you feeling okay? Again, we're talking with
Camilo Arana, and whenever my dad gets pulled over, I'm really scared, and so it was the same. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to do.
Does this happen much? Does he get pulled over much?
Not in a while, but he has, but not a lot.
Or drinking?
I don't think, no.
You've been pulled over in the past by CHP people or by Capitola or Santa Cruz sheriffs? Or?
Well, I, as you can see, I'm a walking conviction. I am brown.
You got the wrong skin color, buddy. I'm sorry. Next.
So, yeah, I
am. Disclosure, you knew me before this interview. We've known each other from political rallies, so I'm not entirely unsympathetic to your case.
Yes, I see that.
On the other hand, I heard the officer's testimony. I heard your testimony. I saw Kim Baskett not offering to give you an immediate disposition, which, of course, she was offering the person before. So that was kind of interesting. The referee didn't say, I'll give you a judgment now if you want. Leading everyone to wonder, you know, whether she was going to, well, I know she's going to let the officer off. I mean, I'd be very surprised if she doesn't. In fact, I want to hear from you if she doesn't. Anyway, the charge was driving without a seatbelt. And also, but your concern was the manner in which the officer then behaved subsequent to your showing your registration and getting a ticket, right?
Exactly. That is mainly my problem. My concern is the behavior of the officer, not the ticket. I have been given tickets in the past, and I pay them. This ticket has been paid for.
You posted bail before going into court, which, by the way, is not the best idea of folks out there, because that way, if you want community service, they'll grab your bail instead. So usually what you want to do, of course, you have to stand in line and make an appointment, but it's often better to, if you're concerned about the money, to, particularly since the bail was
$101.
Okay. So, anyway, you got out of the vehicle.
I got out of the vehicle. And Since I was given a ticket and I was being accused of being drunk and I noticed two statements were false, I was shaken. I was a few yards from my house, so I decided to walk home. And when I got out of my car to walk home, the officer challenged me to a fight. He had some a flashlight or ticket book, whatever, on his hands. He threw it around and he walked towards me and challenged me to a fight, which even scared me more, being that I was with my family there. The officer had not been in uniform. And
now, you said you wanted to walk home. You, well, your car was legally parked in a
parking. It was legally parked, and I was just 100 yards from my house.
And you, okay, and at this point, your wife had driven up in a vehicle and parked behind you?
She was behind the officer's patrol. Three cars were in line.
And how close was she to the situation?
She was about meters. I measure in meters. She was about 20 meters.
How many car lengths?
Three.
And how loudly did the officer speak?
He was loud. In the last exchange, he was very loud.
What
because
exactly did he say? You remember?
He looked at me, getting out of my car, and he said, "Now what? Now you want to fight? You want to fight now?"
Now, how close was he to the car when he said that?
He was 10 meters from me and 10 meters from Camilo's mom.
So about car length and a half?
Yeah, car length and a half.
Now, when the officer testified, when Officer Moyer.
David Moyer.
David.
The first time I had it.
How do you spell that name?
M-O-Y-E-R.
Okay. Now, when Officer Moyer testified, he said that he had followed you through two right turns before you stopped, and he had thought that you were upset when you signed the citation. And in court, you said you had been upset. What's your take on this? Were you upset when you signed the citation? And if so, was it for what reason?
And that is, of course, a case that came up in infraction court where I was interviewing the fellow who was very angry that he had been stopped for a seatbelt ticket. And we're going to be talking more about this case perhaps later, although it seems to have devoted a lot of time to it up to now. But on the line with us now is actually our guest, Susan Prather. Hi, Susan.
How are you?
I'm good. I think we just turned up your mic there. How's everything in Walnut Creek?
Everything is good. We had a good day today, and a lot of comments about an article in the Contra Costa Times that described how volunteers should count homeless people.
Now you're doing you run a social service up in Walnut Creek.
It's a respite center.
And what exactly is a respite center?
Well, it's a place where people can go and sit and be in a quiet, safe place, and they can rest. They can talk to each other with the community of people. They can have breakfast and a late lunch. And we have a food pantry. We have showers, a washer and dryer, and clothing. Brand new underwear.
Uh-huh. Socks.
All kinds of things.
We do have chocolate, of course. That's the key issue. You know.
We have what?
Chocolate.
Of course.
All right. The name of this respite center is?
Fresh Start.
Beautiful.
Fresh Start Walnut Creek. And on the internet, it's freshstartwc.org.
Freshstartwc.org, which should give anyone who's interested and who has access to a computer a way to. You got a history there and some more specifics. You've been doing this program for how long now?
Fresh Start's been around 8 years.
And you serve how many people per day?
Upwards of 35. Towards the end of a month, we get closer to 40.
How many homeless in Walnut Creek?
I would say upwards of 300 or more.
Walnut Creek is a city of how many people?
About 90,000.
Only 300 in a city of 90,000?
No, I'm sure there's more. People are losing their jobs and living in their cars, and eventually I'll see them. But, you know, in the beginning stages of homelessness, I don't. When things get desperate, they land at Fresh Start.
And these are mostly white, black, brown?
We have a pretty diverse group. The majority of people are white, but we have Hispanic people, Asian people, black people. We have gay people, transgender people. We see everybody.
Now, one of the issues, a big issue in Santa Cruz that we keep pressing is the one that has become well, it's gotten headlines in Los Angeles and San Diego, which is the need and right of everyone, and that includes unhoused or homeless people, to sleep at night somewhere legally. And in Los Angeles, of course, people are sleeping wherever they can, but the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals has ruled you have to allow them to sleep in Skid Row at night, as has been requested in an injunction by the ACLU down there.
I've been fighting those kinds of rules and laws for 30 years. I've been doing this work for 30 years, and Fresh Start's been the last 8 years of my life. And it's just ludicrous that any city invokes that kind of ordinance where people can't sleep, stand, lay down, sleep, and meet their basic human needs. You know, politicians are so cowardly they can't act on homelessness at all. And they don't have the political will or the political courage to do the right thing, but they seem to always have the courage to do what's the most cruel.
Well, I know that this has been a big deal in almost every California city of any size, and a lot of particularly the coastal towns, Santa Cruz, Santa Barbara, Santa Monica, Eureka, Arcata, you name it, you know. And they have their own, you know, anti-homeless sleeping laws. We call them sleeping bans in Santa Cruz. Santa Cruz has a very specific ban against sleeping at night. You can't sleep after 11 o'clock or until 8:30 in the morning. You can't cover up with blankets during that period of time. And you can't camp any time of the day or night unless if you have the intention of remaining overnight. Camping is, you know, having camping gear and so forth. Now, what's the story in Walnut Creek? Is there a law against sleeping in Walnut Creek anywhere on public property?
No, there are camping ordinances in the parks, and the parks close at a certain time. But we've kind of come to an agreement that people are homeless there and people need to do certain things in order to survive. And we have a very nice relationship with the police department, and we help each other. The people that I serve are part of the community at Fresh Start, and they participate in meetings with the police department. If there's a problem on the street, we try to solve it before the police are necessary. Business people will often call Fresh Start if there's a problem with a person who appears to be homeless. I will, or someone from Fresh Start will go out and talk to the individual and see what we can do to help. And if people find, if the police find people sleeping in their cars or in the parks, they give them my card and ask them to go to Fresh Start to get some help.
Now, by help, do you mean, are you an emergency shelter service?
Not an emergency shelter. We're a drop-in center. But we can often help people if they want to return home. We can do that. We can help people find the help that they need that they wouldn't get if they were just isolated on the street. And we certainly don't force people to get help. We're there for them to have a respite and food and water. And we provide a lot of bottled water because water is very hard to get now that it's all been privatized. And, we do what we can, and we do it at the individual's pace and consent.
Does Walnut Creek have public bathrooms?
Yes.
24-hour bathrooms?
Yes.
How many?
I have no idea, but everybody knows where the bathrooms are that are open.
Well, maybe you should call the mayor of Santa Cruz, Emily Riley, and tell her to take a page from Walnut Creek's book. In the studio with me, I have a
When I first started working in Walnut Creek, when I was invited by the city to do to come up with something that served the people there that wasn't duplicated anywhere else, one of the first things I did was begin to work with the police department and communicate with them, as well as communicate with the people who lived on the streets. And, it's a real open conversation that the police didn't really want me in town. And over the years, we've learned a lot from each other, including the people I serve have taught us all a lot. And, the general consensus is that we talk to each other and we include the people who are living on the street in that discussion. You can avoid a lot of problems and save a lot of money just by talking and treating people as human beings.
Sounds good, but what do you do at night when people need to sleep? That's my question.
We provide tents, sleeping bags, and tarps.
So you're saying that Walnut Creek people have At least 300 homeless people have tents they sleep in at night somewhere outside.
Or cars. A lot of people sleep in cars.
And police ignore these people and allow them to sleep without molesting them.
More or less, yeah. Absolutely. And it's, you know, people know where it's a good place to sleep, and they know where it's not a good place to sleep. And it's not my business where people sleep, Robert. I don't know where people sleep. If somebody asked me, I could name a few places, but I don't know where everybody sleeps. Mm-hmm. But I give them what I can to help them stay warm and dry and healthy.
Well, if this is true, and I'm frankly rather skeptical, even though you're on the scene and you're telling me it is, this is a blatant exception to every other city I've ever heard about. I mean, there are some cities that have provided programs like Eugene, Oregon, where people could park. And they appointed a social service person to deal with problems in lieu of a police officer.
Come and visit.
I'd like to. Walnut Creek's main business is what?
It's a central upscale shopping area.
It's a large shopping mall.
No, it's many, many stores and restaurants.
And I mean, what it's just a bedroom community.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there's no manufacturing or
no.
So we're talking about upper middle class white people who don't freak out when homeless people are sleeping in their cars nearby. Is that what you're saying?
Yep.
And has this changed from when you originally, you know, opened Fresh Start? I guess back in what, 1998?
Yes, it has.
And describe for me what police used to do and what back before the Fresh Start came into the scene.
I'm sorry.
What did police used to do when homeless people showed up sleeping in a vehicle?
We, you know, there were areas that people couldn't sleep, you know, if there were problems or the property owners complained.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that's still the case. If the property owner complains, then it's an issue. But we try to keep things, you know, the communication open. And
now, but what happened before, Susan? We're talking with Susan Prather of Fresh Start in Walnut Creek on Free Radio Santa Cruz. For those of you
who just tuned in. Or less before I came, it was
You say you were around for 30 years or so, and you were struggling with this issue, and then you started Fresh Start, right?
Right.
So before, now I don't mean before you came. I mean before you started Fresh Start.
Before I came, there were people there who had lived there long term, and everybody knew who everybody was, but there wasn't much problem. You know, there's just not a whole lot of problems. And it's, you know, everybody's kind of, they're part of the community. People know who they are. People come to Fresh Start and donate clothing and all kinds of things. And they see people there and they talk to them on the street. And they, oh, that's my friend from Fresh Start. They don't say that's some homeless guy. So it's a whole different attitude. Before I came,
I mean, before you started Fresh Start.
Before I started Fresh Start, right. I think it was probably more low key and more under the radar, and I think you know, probably the police might have asked people to leave town, and they might have come down harder on them.
Do you actually know? I mean, you said you've been working in this area prior to coming to Fresh Start, prior to starting it.
Yeah, I knew a lot of people in Walnut Creek before I started Fresh Start. I knew people were there.
I mean, were you active?
I knew where I knew where a lot of them lived 10, 12 years ago.
Are there organizations other than Fresh Start that are concerned with civil rights for homeless people in Walnut Creek, or are we in a situation which you describe as very idyllic?
Not many people in Contra Costa are concerned with civil rights of the homeless. In Walnut Creek, we have a very rare agreement and relationship with the people who can infringe on the civil rights of the people who are homeless. I mean, as far as the rest of the county, I don't think anybody gives a damn what happens to homeless people.
Right.
I mean, if it comes to my attention, I go there and try to do something. I'm always on the phone to the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, who has helped us in Concord, where they wouldn't let people use a park that was located behind Loaves and Fishes, even though it was a public park.
Mm-hmm.
The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights helped us in Richmond overturn the cruel ordinance like they have in Santa Cruz, that where people couldn't sit, stand, or lie down. And now that's the one you called me about originally. But it's
yeah, we don't actually have, it doesn't say, our community leaders, if you will, or misleaders, are much more clever than that. They don't say you can't sit, stand, you can't. They don't say you can't sit, sleep, or lie down, as the Los Angeles ordinance says. They say you can't sleep at night, and you can't sit down within 10 feet of a business when most of the sidewalks are 10 feet wide. In other words, they give small outs so that they can claim their ordinances are constitutional, and that's, of course...
Well, that's what they did in Richmond when they passed the really cruel ordinance, similar to that one. They called it a camping ordinance, and the mayor, the then mayor, Irma Anderson, and a woman who was on the council by the name of Mindell Penn, she's gone now, and then a woman who's now the head of the Planning Commission, and I can't remember her name, but they called it a camping ordinance, and they explained that it was not there to harm or interfere with homeless people. They claimed that people were coming to Richmond and camping in cars and in the parks and in motorhomes because they wanted to see San Francisco on the cheap. Now, isn't that a good one? People were just flocking to Richmond.
It
was a destination city for people who wanted to see San Francisco
Richmond,
on the cheap.
Amazing. You know, that's what former mayor Mike Rotkin, and he's now our council member, used as an argument to defeat modifications and reforms in the sleeping ban that we put forward in 1999, and still claimed on this program, actually, I guess 6 or 8 months ago when I interviewed him. You know, he claims that, you know, in Santa Cruz, if you allowed people to sleep legally somewhere, you'd get people coming from all over to just come and sleep in the streets.
That's not true.
Which, of course, is, you know, yeah, it's hogwash. I mean, at least that, it's interesting. I mean, here in Santa Cruz, we have a committee set up by the city council that actually came to the same conclusion, that this so-called magnet effect...
Well, they've been talking about that for years,
doesn't
but
really
I've never
happen.
Seen it. Have you seen it?
No. I mean, on rare occasions where people are driven out of the community next door, like when Mayor Jordan in San Francisco drove homeless people out in the Matrix program, they did come to Santa Cruz because they were driven out of another community.
Well, that's what happened.
But the idea,
what we've found is that if you talk to people and if we treat the cops like human beings and if we treat the people who are living on the streets like human beings and we have a common sense approach and meet somewhere in the middle, we can accomplish a hell of a lot more than you can by running people around and making them do things that are stupid.
Susan Prather, you sound entirely too reasonable, so let me introduce a more unreasonable person into this discussion. And with me in the studio is that mad guitarist, Grinmaster Greg, as I insist on calling him. Greg here is a man who plays with SAFE, Society for Artistic and Freedom and Expression, which every week, actually several times a week these days, takes back space in violation of our laws on Pacific Avenue in order to open it up to homeless people, ordinary people, musicians, you know, you and me, in violation of the city's rather rigid it's not just anti-homeless, it's sort of a gentrified merchant code downtown that makes the use of the sidewalks very difficult. Hello, Greg.
Yes, aloha to you, Susan.
I'm
familiar with Walnut Creek. I attended the Berkeley there for a number of years, and I'd go over on the other side of the East Bay Hills every once in a while. I'd go through your illustrious town. Certainly was more of an affluent area that I could see. And over the years, I've definitely volunteered at drop-in centers and respite centers. I know exactly what they are. But based upon what you're telling me, seems to me, especially after this worldwide broadcast tonight, you can expect that magnet effect to take over. They're going to have a busting influx of people just dying to get to Walnut Creek.
Well, I hope not, because that'll certainly hurt the people that are already there.
Correct. I'm saying that somewhat facetiously. But it does sound like a good thing, because persecution seems to be the name of the game for people who are marginalized.
And when you marginalize and persecute, people get hurt, nobody gets help. But if you talk together and try and work out some reasonable solutions and include everybody in the discussion, you can accomplish a lot.
Absolutely.
And that's what we've done.
But sometimes we have to be gadflies, it seems like.
Well, I've been that for years. And after that, I started Fresh Start because I learned a lot in all the years I'd been making trouble.
Well, tell me about your gadfly days, because I'm still stuck in the gadfly larval stage here. What were you doing before you started this Fresh Start group? What kinds of struggles were you engaged in?
Always homeless work. I started working with people who were very vulnerable in the 70s, and then in the 80s, I started to see people who were homeless, and I worked with Mitch Snyder a lot in Washington, D.C., and mostly worked in the Richmond area, organizing people We held marches in tent cities and did a lot of things here and drew a lot of attention to the issue. They didn't even have, when I started, there was no shelters in Contra Costa County, and I'm sorry they ever built them because they're horrible. But, when I was working on the streets here in Richmond, the county had a hotline that you could call, and if you were homeless, they would put you in a motel, but they never published the number. So I used to take it to the streets and gather people at a payphone and make the county put people in motels. And God knows how much money I spent. I've heard it was in the millions. And then they retaliated by starting to give people motels way out of the area that people that were walking couldn't get to. And then I raised a lot of hell, and then they had to take them in cabs. It's been interesting. I've been to jail for justice. I've done my time there. I've done a lot of different things and learned a long time ago that if you could make people laugh at the powers that be, you could usually win.
Your most recent victory that I know of was your victory at the Richmond City Council with Elisa de la Plana. And others fighting the Richmond camping law you talked about. Can you give us a kind of a blow-by-blow of what went down there?
I read about the ruling in Los Angeles by the appeals court.
The Jones decision.
And immediately got a hold of Elisa Del Piano and Orrin Sellstrom at the Lawyers Committee and saw it as an opportunity to do some work to get the ordinance overturned in Richmond. And we started that discussion, and Gail McLaughlin, who's now the mayor, was then a council person, and she participated in that and took it to the council. And it took two readings, and they did overturn the ordinance based on the appeals court decision.
Well, it's interesting. Yours is the only city that I know of other than San Diego and Los Angeles, because those are big cities, and the city councils haven't overturned their ordinances. They're still appealing, but they've told the police and the city attorneys to stop enforcing, or at least the city attorney and the police chiefs have decided down there to stop enforcing, as far as I know. And in Richmond, however, I'm looking at the camping ordinance now, the camping ordinance that you were able to persuade, what's her name, Mayor McLaughlin?
Yeah.
To put forward. It says a lot of things, but it says, it shall be unlawful for any person to camp, sleep in, or occupy camp facilities or use camp paraphernalia in the following areas except as otherwise provided. Any street, any parking lot, public area, or open spaces, improved or unimproved, provided, however, that no person shall be in violation of this section unless, this is your great contribution, the person is informed of the whereabouts of homeless shelters in the city of Richmond, such shelter is actually available to such person, and such person willingly refuses to stay in such shelter. Now, of course, you've just said, and I agree with you, that shelters are for shit, in so many words, and therefore it's not really a very good alternative, but it's at least it puts the stops them from being arrested for just sheltering themselves or sleeping.
And the shelters are always full, so there's no chance that ordinance can be enforced.
Well, that's my question to you. I mean, and I asked you that a few days ago. In Miami in 1998, as you probably know, in the so-called Pottinger decision, massive lawsuit that began 10 years before ended in a settlement which homeless people who had originally had numbers written on their arms, like, you know, Jews in concentration camps. First, they were the federal judge down there, Clyde Atkins, gave them safe zones to sleep in. When that didn't work, they evolved the Pottinger guidelines, meaning that the city did not follow the safe zones court order. The final settlement was an agreement that they had to, before even approaching a homeless person, not just for sleeping, but for any so-called life-sustaining misdemeanor, which could include warming yourself at a fire, taking a crap, you name it, they had to have a shelter bed available. But what the police have done since, according to an interview I had with an ACLU attorney connected with that case about 4 years ago, they intentionally keep a couple of shelter beds available so they can threaten people with them.
No, they don't do that here.
You mean in Richmond?
No.
So what have you found? Because I know you said you didn't have any stats a few days ago. You've been doing some researching. You've come to some. You got some more.
Yeah, I haven't heard back. We sent some emails asking for some information, and I haven't heard back. But at the last I heard, which was a couple of months ago, I heard that they weren't being ticketed.
So
where did you hear
I
that
need
from?
To get an update on that, and it didn't come in time for tonight. I apologize for that.
No, that's okay, man. I'd love to hear from you when you get that information. But where did you hear this last previous report from?
A friend of mine works closely with the city and keeps an eye on this ordinance, and that's what he told me, and he's a pretty good source.
Because the Richmond Police Department, I'm told, is no great shakes. They're not the most honest and gentle group in town. I've heard some nasty things about the Richmond Police Department.
Well, they're trying to improve.
Are they?
They're trying to improve.
Are they?
Yeah, I don't know.
I appreciate the optimistic attitude, but I don't like false optimism.
No, they don't. Have a great reputation.
Nope.
And
you have a completely
they
ridiculous,
haven't had since the days of the Cowboys. They have, however, the city did hire a new police chief, and he says that he is going to change the department, and that
does,
remains
eh?
To be seen. So
I see.
Well, I don't know.
That's nice. I don't know who would have these statistics, and frankly, I got to tell you, I'm skeptical about Walnut Creek too. Although I understand what you're saying. It's hard for a city of 90,000, which doesn't harass its homeless people for sleeping, is a true anomaly, if that's the case. And I can believe Fresh Start has done some wonderful things, but it's hard for me to believe that, first of all, it's hard to believe there are 300 homeless people in a city of 90,000. I can't believe that. Because I know that, generally speaking, in Santa Cruz, we have 55,000 people here in the city, and like we have 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people. And in the county, we have like 250.
I'm just telling you the ones I see. I can't.
Right, right.
I can't
account
for the ones I don't see.
Right, and I'm not an expert census taker, so I don't, I could be wrong in my figures. I just, I'm eager to see us, to, duplicate the success you've done, even if you... there's all kinds of harassment going on that you're not being told about, but it sounds like you would hear about it on the grapevine. I mean, you're in touch with homeless people, right? We're not just talking about us.
People, and I'm in touch with the cops. I hear both sides.
And you don't mind speaking up when you see some shit going down. It sounds
like
you
don't.
No, I don't. Yeah. So I don't think that you're, trying to play footsie with the authorities. Although you say that it has been helpful conversations with the police and that kind of.
But I don't hesitate to raise hell either, or call the lawyers committee if there's something going on that's wrong.
And the last time that happened was this Richmond incident before.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have any sense of what's going on over in Berkeley? I hear bad things about the police proceeding to harass people and for sleeping in vehicles, for sleeping outside.
Yeah, it never used to happen in Berkeley in the early days of my work, but it's gone that way. The array of the retailers is similar to Santa Cruz.
Has Walnut Creek changed as a community in the last 20 or 30 years in a similar fashion?
Oh, yeah, it was a sleepy bedroom community. Now there's, there's more upscale businesses and retails and restaurants.
On another subject, since I've got you on the line. What's happening with the anti-war movement up there? Is there much action happening coming up this Saturday?
There's a great anti-war movement both in Richmond and Walnut Creek, the two communities that I'm closest to. Walnut Creek has a wonderful, wonderful active group at the Peace Center, the Peace and Justice Center. And there are marches and rallies. There's Grandparents for Peace who vigil every week. There's, a lot of stuff going on with the anti-war movement there, and they're very, very active. Hmm. And we support all of the things that they do. We participate in that at Fresh Start.
Because down here in Santa Cruz, we're planning a protest tomorrow, actually, in front of the vice mayor's business, which is the Bookshop Santa Cruz. I don't know if you've ever been down to Santa Cruz and been to the Bookshop Santa Cruz. It's traditionally considered a very liberal place.
I remember the unknown chefs that used to get arrested when they fed people.
Oh, yeah, that was one of the unknown food servers. I don't think I ever ventured into the kitchen, but I was out there serving the food. We had a group called SWAP, Soup Without a Permit, that fed. And then, of course, Keith McHenry and Food Not Bombs came down and served as well. And indeed, recently, the Potter's Hand, Dennis Adams, has been driven out of the parking garage on Sunday mornings, which is generally empty, because they've evolved a new anti-homeless law that makes it illegal to go into a parking garage at all unless you have a vehicle or a bicycle, and then if you do, only for 15 minutes. This is
the most egregious thing today is the stupid count of the homeless that HUD is doing.
Tell me about that.
And they're counting, I think, in San Francisco Monday and Contra Costa Tuesday and somewhere else on Wednesday. And there was an article in the paper today where some of the people who work for the county were training people to count homeless people. And they said that you could tell people were homeless by their jerky movements, if they were disoriented, and look at their shoes and see if they're carrying bags. And I sent an email to the person and said, wouldn't it be better to help someone that you describe in that way than to just count them and give them a number? And then the next paragraph, and this is what we were all talking about at Fresh Start today, it was really hilarious. They said, except for Walnut Creek, where the people blend a little more, they're clean, and they have nicer clothes.
What a deal.
We blame Fresh Start for this.
That's Fresh Start. And we were laughing, and they said, except for their shoes. You can always tell by their shoes. So we decide we got to order a lot of shoe polish.
Yeah, whip out the shoe polish there, Susan.
And but the best line of the day was that somebody at Fresh Start decided we should count rich people. So at the end of the day, somebody was downtown and called me and said she counted 40 rich people.
Well, I guess, this is all part of this what I consider to be a largely bogus 10-year plan to end homelessness.
Yeah, bogus 10-year plan. But they have to count, they have to have a homeless count every other year in order to qualify for HUD funding, cities, counties, you know.
How many
and,
shelters?
You know, what are we, 8 years into the 10-year plan, and it's worse than ever?
Well, that's what I want to hear from you, because, frankly, my social service awarenesses are limited. I'm more, you know, an agitator on the civil rights issue. Although I hear some nasty things about our local homeless service center that we're actually going to have a 65...
Anything that's a service center or, you know, is an agency, I mean, what it takes is a place to build community with people and rise up from there and raise people up. You know, you don't do it by holding people down and telling them you're an agency and they'll do what you say. And it's not what works.
Well, we have a problem. It's not simply they aren't being raised up, but this is a homeless service center where there are complaints that people's property is being ripped off, that there's corruption in the management.
Oh, that's true everywhere.
Of course,
I mean, that's
of course.
What those places
but,
are
I mean,
like.
I can only talk about, you know, specific complaints I hear about here. I mean, I can talk about it elsewhere, too. We're talking to Susan Prather of Fresh Start in Walnut Creek. This is Bathrop's Pier's Broadsides at 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norse. In the studio with me is Gregory, and we're talking about your successful struggle in May and June of last year to reform the Richmond camping ordinance with actually the help, amazingly enough, of the mayor of the city, Mayor Gail McLaughlin.
She's now the mayor. At that time, she was a council person. She's a Green Party member.
Well, the Green Party has not had a lot of good press down here from us. We had, as I mentioned before earlier in the show, Tim Fitzmaurice, who is a Green Party mayor, who actually helped make the laws against the homeless worse and violated the state Green Party platform. You're a Green yourself? Or?
No, I'm not.
You're not.
I'm an extremely liberal Democrat. I'm a rare breed these days.
Oh,
you know? Nobody claims to be liberal. Everybody's progressive.
Uh-huh. Well, whatever. It sounds like
and there's different wings to the Democratic Party. I'm more of a Democratic Socialist, I guess.
Now, is Lynn Woolsey your representative, or
who?
Lynn Woolsey.
Miller, George Miller.
Oh, George Miller. Okay. Yeah, I was going to do some reading on this show today of the latest shenanigans of the Senate and their "let's all oppose Bush's war, but don't do anything about it" sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I guess I'll do that on Sunday.
They're not doing anything to raise people up on the minimum wage issue either. I mean,
right. Well, I mean, we tried here in Santa Cruz to pass a measure, Measure G, and all the great progressives and liberals, the merchants suddenly showed their true colors, which was green, like the lining of their pocketbooks, you know.
Yeah, it'd raise the cost of their latte, wouldn't it?
It would. It would be difficult. You know, we'd like to help, but that's really, as they say about the homeless, it's a state and a national issue. You know, it's not something we can solve ourselves.
For 25 years, people have been saying it's a federal issue, it's a national issue, and they've really done nothing substantial to help homeless people other than throw money at it. And waste it.
And the money usually goes to these middle class.
Nobody's built low-income housing. Nobody's built housing that's affordable, and no one's created jobs. In fact, we've lost hundreds of thousands of jobs in this country. And, yeah. You know, that's what it takes is housing and jobs.
I guess there's some small,
where are they?
There's some small amount of low-income housing that's been built in Santa Cruz. But, I mean, for me, the issue, at least for people right now, is if you haven't got access to emergency shelter, you shouldn't be arrested for sleeping and for trying to provide it for yourself. And that's why you want to round up all those folks that you were able to assist you to do the same thing with our city council, or at least maybe to do the same thing with our community. The city council seems intractable on this issue. That's the problem we have. As I said, tomorrow we're going to be having a protest in front of Bookshop Santa Cruz, which is Vice Mayor Coonerty's baby, so to speak. And I was telling you before, Bookshop Santa Cruz is a very liberal store. I mean, they often let homeless people sleep outside their store. They have a bathroom, the only public bathroom in town on private property. One of the few. I think there's another one now at Trader Joe's, which is open to the public, even who are not customers. I mean, we have such a rigid situation that many of the restaurants downtown, many of the coffee shops, like the Coffee Roasting Company, does not allow even their customers to use the bathroom.
And that's happening in a lot of places.
It's amazing. So I'm going to encourage people on your dime here while you're talking to come tomorrow at noon to the Bookshop Santa Cruz. And that means you, Grinmaster Greg, with your guitar and do some.
Depends if I'm awake.
If you're awake, yes. You can go to sleep on the sidewalk, but that would be illegal in Santa Cruz during the day downtown. Not only is it illegal to sleep at night, but it's illegal to lie down on the sidewalk downtown. So we may have to have a lie-in, and that's no lie.
It's not too comfortable anyway.
Anyway, Susan, I appreciate your coming on the air. I want to talk to you again.
Well, call me anytime, but come and visit.
That's for sure.
Yeah, well, I've got your phone number, and if I can ever find my way to Walnut Creek, I think it's somewhere on the map to the right of San Francisco somewhere.
It is behind. To the right of San Francisco.
But maybe it's to the left in a certain
it's
sense.
Over the East Bay Hills on the other side.
Yeah, well, we're
going to... We have carved out a very progressive, hopeful place for people to be, and it can be replicated. You can do it anywhere, and if people are open to that kind of change in attitudes in cities and whatever, it can happen, and it can be progressive, and it can be hopeful, and, you know, talking to people, working with people, keeping the conversation open and going, it works a hell of a lot better than blame and name-calling.
Well, fuck them is what I have to say. But
I say that a lot, too.
Right.
It's one of my favorite words.
But I hear you.
Yeah.
What are you saying?
Matter of fact, a fresh start, I'm the only one that gets to say it, and I say it a lot.
My goodness. Well, you can say it any time on free radio. And, you know, I'm going to call you. I'm looking for those updates because, frankly, I would like to, if the police are, in fact, so gentle as you claim and so reasonable in Walnut Creek, then you know if you get the records for the last couple of years, you'll find out that there haven't been arrests for homeless people for loitering or sleeping. Are you saying you have no law in Walnut Creek that is used to pick up a homeless person for sleeping at night?
No.
Wow.
No, it hasn't. If there is one, it hasn't been used.
There's a state code.
The other thing you should know about what we do is that Fresh Start's a community service project through the courts. And the courts work with us to keep people out of jail. In fact, just Tuesday, I got a referral from a judge, a man that I think any other city would have put in jail. And he got a ticket for public urination, and the judge sent him to Fresh Start to do community service instead of putting him in jail for a week.
Well, we have that here, too, and that's great. But the problem is, in the first instance, what happens to people who try to sleep? And I guess what you're telling me is they are either ignored, or if there's a problem, they're directed to your group, not as emergency shelter, but what, to get a ticket somewhere else or something?
What?
If a person in Walnut Creek is sleeping, a homeless person out of about 90,000 people, a few of those people are sleeping, and the police don't want them to do that for some reason, they either they send them to you and ask you to, and then you give them a ticket for
if
somewhere.
If they're sleeping in an area that's not a great place to sleep, they are just given my card, and they're told to come and see me.
Are they rousted in the middle of the night? Or
no.
They aren't?
Very rarely. Mm-hmm. Very rarely.
Well, I'm going to have to grill you further on this whole issue, Susan.
Well, why don't you come and talk to me, and we'll talk to some cops together.
I may come undercover as a homeless person with a sleeping bag in downtown Walnut Creek, and we'll see what happens.
well, just don't do anything that's going to ruin it for the people I serve, because they've worked hard to make this happen.
You mean no drinking or breaking windows?
You mean you don't have drunks and alcoholics there?
Sure we do.
Druggies and that kind of stuff?
Sure we do.
Oh, okay, just curious.
Where do they sleep?
Wherever they happen to be, I guess. I don't know where people sleep.
And they don't get arrested.
That's not my business.
They don't get arrested or hassled for it.
I'm sorry?
They don't get arrested or hassled for it.
It depends on what they're doing.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
Yeah. Okay,
you know, there may not be a lot of cover sleeping, but there's laws that cover a lot of things, and, you know, it's just...
Well, that's what they're doing in Los Angeles. As you probably know, there are massive protests going on in L.A. every week. Homeless people are now kind of doing camp-ins because police, while they're banned from using the sleeping ban, they can't arrest people under sleeping. They're using every other law they can to drive
them
away.
Yeah, well, that's not happening here either. I mean, it's they don't go out of their way to hurt people.
Okay,
is what I'm saying.
Well, okay, Susan, I'm gonna if not take you at your word, at least suspend my disbelief. And thank you for being on the show.
Well, it's the cooperation.
Aloha,
all
Susan.
The way around.
And again, we're talking with Susan Prather. Her website is freshstartwc.org. You can check it out, freshstartwc.org. Thanks a lot, Susan.
Thanks, Robert.
All righty. Bye-bye. Susan's also a writer for Street Spirit Newspaper. This month, we're not going to have a Street Spirit newspaper much, except there will be one in the library. It's the poetry issue. You'll be able to, if you go to the main branch of the library, you can read the poets there. And next month, there'll be Street Spirits available both at the Homeless Service Center, Page Smith Community House, and through our fine distribution center through the good works of Troublesome Thomas Levitt, who is a distributor for Street Spirit. That's almost it for Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, because very soon the infamous Uncle Dennis will come creaming into the studio with his dregs, and I don't know what to say about that. The show is called From the Cream to the Dregs. And that'll be that. Again, I want to remind you, all of you, that tomorrow at noon, I will be sitting in front of a table at the Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown on Pacific Avenue, pushing papers and trying to get you to sign up and maybe even to go and talk to Vice Mayor Coonerty about his unusual positions on these issues. He has a position that, first he said, there's no such thing as a sleeping ban in Santa Cruz. It's a camping ban. I told him, no, go back and read the law again.
Camping.
And I got a phone call from him today, which I'll talk about on Sunday. Not very enlightening, but we're trying, all that dialogue and all that sort of thing. We have a caller. Hi there, caller. You're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. Hey, Robert.
Bernard.
Yeah, thank you for having that interview. I thought it was very different kind of interview than I've ever, heard before in this, part of the movement.
Uh-huh.
I'd really like to urge you, or somebody, like maybe Becky or somebody that can really write this up and get much deeper into what they're doing there. I think some of that could be very valuable here. However, I want to pick on you for one thing, Robert.
Uh-huh.
You made a crack before the interview about Fitzmaurice. Now, you know that I don't think very much of Fitzmaurice.
Uh-huh.
However, of what you did say, I kind of thought you were unfair.
How
and
so?
Let me tell you why, all right?
Okay.
Are you there?
I'm here.
Because Fitzmaurice, when he ran for city council, he did not run on a green platform. I can be registered in the Peace and Freedom Party. It doesn't mean that when I run for office that I'm running as a Peace and Freedom Party person and beholden to the Peace and Freedom Party platform.
Actually, what he did was he made specific statements about the right to sleep in Santa Cruz, and he violated them after he came to office.
Right, but that's correct, and I agree with you on that. But
he also got one issue. He got the Green Party endorsement on 2 years running. He actually got the Green Party endorsement on one occasion.
A Green Party candidate.
You're getting technical with me. As far as I'm concerned, if the Green Party does not repudiate what he has done, the Green Party and him both are showing themselves to be hypocrites, or at least they're showing themselves to be violating human rights for homeless people on that issue.
I can agree with you on that.
Uh-huh.
That the Green Party has never held him accountable for their endorsement. But it doesn't mean, that he was beholden to to the Green Party platform on all city business. That's what I'm getting at.
Well, that's fine. I mean, I think we're getting technical and splitting hairs here. He stated he would end the sleeping ban. He didn't. He lied about it.
He backed
away from it. So therefore, he also I don't know specifically if he referenced the Green Party state platform, which talks about laws criminalizing the homeless.
I doubt it.
And that, that
I doubt and, that very strongly.
But I don't think that, you know, I call him a phony green because I think he did talk about he came to Green Party meetings. You know, he's a green. He's a green mayor.
That's
horseshit.
True.
Thank
and
you.
And he may be a phony green. I don't got a problem
with you. Let's stop arguing about it.
He did not run on a Green Party platform. But anyway, I don't want to.
I never said he ran
okay?
on a Green Party platform.
But that's only one issue. There's hundreds of issues that the Greens have to say about how city
I'm talking about that one issue.
Work.
I'm talking about that one issue.
Are you there?
I'm here. And I'm talking about that one issue. But I got to go. So,
okay,
bye-bye. Thanks for calling, Amber. So that's it for Bathroom Spears Broadsides for this week. Come in again on Sunday, or I should say tune in again on Sunday. And I'll be back at 9:30. Thomas Levitt comes in at 7:30 and sometimes has homeless civil rights history tapes that he plays on his show, The Wake Up Call. If you want to catch me off air, you can give me a call on the Huff line. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. This show is archived on the Huff website, www.huffsantacruz.org. And I will be down, as I say, tomorrow at noon in front of Bookshop Santa Cruz with a petition for you to sign, if you want, around the Jones case. Maybe we can bring Walnut Creek to Santa Cruz. Could it be? We'll see. Thank you, and thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrob Spears Broadsides.
My fellow Americans, the kids are screaming and the house is a mess. But this here is our home and we've been truly blessed. The wife and I live on Pennsylvania Avenue. Cause Al Gore's hanging chads became that much more few. I'm a uniter, not a divider. And my Texas strategery was a sleeve of my ace. Now I'm the commandeer of the earth and the space. I love being American, quite rightly I do. But if you live someplace else, fear my red, white, and blue. We cannot let terriers hold this nation hostile. I'll smoke them out. Kids are screaming and the house is a mess. This here is our home and we've been truly blessed. I've got a powerful Air Force, Navy, Army, Marines. I'll shock and awe you with my high-tech machines. Don't underestimate me, cause I'm way too smart. I can reconstruct countries or just blow them apart. Since more and more imports come from overseas, I should tell those French people I don't like stinky cheese. You know, the problem with the French is they don't have a word for entrepreneur. But right now I'm busy starting a new war. Me and my buddies got a plan for 4 more years, that is. The kids are screaming and the house is a mess. But this here's our home and we've been truly blessed. I've been real successful since my election bid. Everything I could have done, I accomplished or overdid. I gave healthy tax cuts to the wealthy, my friends. The tax cuts for poor folk, that's all just pretend, make-believe, hogwash. But you gotta forgive me, cause I like to spend. Wars cost real money, and sometimes they don't end. Where's the money come from? Well, I'd rather not say. But the truth of the matter is, I don't know anyway. Show me the money, $87 billion. Print me the money. The kids are screaming and the house is a mess. But this here's our home and we've been truly blessed. Outside my house, I hear talk in the streets. I hear misgruntled people complaining about me. The children are screaming, I've done something wrong. Can't we love one another like it says in that song? So what if the House is in such a big mess? So is the Senate. Blame them Democrats, I guess. The kids are screaming and the House is a mess. But this here is our home, and we've been truly blessed. God bless America. And that's an order. Just kidding, God. Don't smite me. I think we agree the past is over. Past is over. I think we agree. I think we agree the past is over. We're making the right decisions to bring the solution to an end.
Heading home to San Diego, they could almost see the dock. The USS Abe Lincoln was returning from Iraq. They were thinking of their loved ones, they were thinking of a home. Of the many sad and lonely nights on the battlefront alone, he stepped out on the flight deck in a fighter pilot suit. You know, dress up can be fun, make believe is cute. But I wonder what they wondered as they surveyed the scene after all they'd been through, after what they'd seen. Cause life is hard, times are tough, when the going gets too rough and the truth's just not good enough, let's pretend. Yeah, let's pretend I fly an airplane. Let's pretend I fought in war. Let's pretend I wasn't AWOL for 16 months or more. Let's pretend I know exactly what you folks are going through. Let's pretend that everything I say is absolutely true. Life is hard, times are tough, and when the going gets a little rough and the truth's just not good enough, oh, let's pretend, let's pretend, let's pretend. And let's pretend Iraq is grateful. Let's pretend they waved and cheered. Let's pretend this whole damn thing isn't getting too damn weird. Let's pretend we found some weapons. Let's pretend we caught Saddam. Let's pretend this doesn't feel a bit like Vietnam. Cause life is hard, times are tough, and when the going gets just a little too rough, and when the truth's just not good enough, let's pretend, let's pretend, let's pretend this is a solo. Pretend affirmative action had nothing to do with me and Yale, and the fact that despite three arrests, I never went to jail. Cause three strikes and you're out is for losers and for jerks, for guys who have to fight in wars, for guys who gotta work. And life is hard, times are tough, and when the going gets a little rough, and when the truth is just not good enough, let's pretend, let's pretend, let's pretend, let's pretend, let's pretend, let's pretend, let's pretend. Ah, mission accomplished.
And with that, we leave Robert Norse as programming, and he will, of course, be back on Sunday morning at an hour far too early for me to contemplate. But anyway, do stay tuned Sunday morning at 9:30, right, for Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. See you then, Robert. I'm Uncle Dennis. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz at a frequency of 101.1 megahertz on your FM dial in the northern Monterey Bay area. And you can pick us up on the wide, weird web, www.freakradio.org, where all kinds of strange streaming goes on. And then, of course, you could find us at radio.indymedia.org, where a whole bunch of other streaming goes on. And we're just one little part of that. But anyway, welcome to From the Cream to the Dregs, a weekly exploration of the music of the 60s and the 70s. And we're going to start just a little bit early in terms of, music. We're going to do what's called going back to the roots. And that involves getting down with a cat by the name of Buddy.
If you knew Peggy Sue, then you'd know why I feel blue without Peggy. My Peggy Sue. Oh, well, I love you, Kelly. I love you, Peggy Sue. Peggy Sue, Peggy Sue. Oh, how my heart yearns for you. Oh, Peggy, my Peggy Sue. Oh, well, I love you, Kelly. I love you, Peggy Sue. Peggy Sue, Peggy Sue. Pretty, 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 pretty Peggy Sue. Oh, oh, Peggy, my Peggy Sue. Oh, well, I love you, gal, and I need you, Peggy Sue.
I love you, Peggy Sue, with a love so rare and true. Oh, Peggy, my Peggy Sue. I want you, Peggy Sue. Yes, I need you, Peggy Sue. I love you, Peggy Sue, with a love so rare and true. Oh, Peggy, my Peggy Sue. Oh, well, I love you, gal, and I want you, Peggy Sue. Oh, well, I love you, gal, and I want you.
Tease me like you do. I'm so in love with you.